From the heart of Montana, this is Big Sky, Small World, Carroll College's student podcast. Big Sky, Small World, I can never have Montana.
Aboard, choo-choo. Today we got quite a story to tell all you listeners of Big Sky, Small World. This is the Trucha Train Station Workshop, where as your newly hired conductor, I will be guiding a non-stop run through the numerous topics my mind seems to think is so important to fixate on. Well, ladies and gentlemen, today is truly a somber day for the Train Station Workshop, LLC. Has gone completely bankrupt. Meaning any railroad bonds that have been purchased in anticipation to manipulate the stock market and earn enormous profits to become the next Warren Buffett has been deflated as the choo-choo financial bubble has burst. No longer can guests be able to ride. This is not a train for those of the top 1%, the lavish of society, as stipulated a few episodes ago. The train is decommissioned. The insides have been gutted to pay off our debt that is three times larger than the United States national debt, which sits around $36 trillion. So if you do some math and times that by three, you should get around five. But before we go, let us learn the fates of those fortunate to step aboard. Our first passenger, Henry, had quietly slipped off the train in the middle of the night before I could wish him farewell. For he received a vision of his future after speaking with yours truly. A quest to see all and heal those he can, to heed the call as a son of God. He has now gone off to become a neurosurgeon while simultaneously conducting a 195-country book tour for his acclaimed 50-consecutive edition book series. The course material is so thick and complicated that scientists have estimated that by the time his traveling across the world is done and he is halfway to his final destination to go to Mars, readers will be halfway through the 20th book. Our second passenger, Alejandro, after numerous requests and the temptation to see Boston crabs, decided to leave the first class lounge of his own initiative. For legal reasons, I have been told by his lawyer, me, to include this in the statement. Despite nervousness to leave, he has now earned more degrees than Bill Russell has sport rings. 11, by the way. Yet, he still lives in his parents' basement. The urban legend goes that if you gander over to peek through the ground level window at 2 a.m. and listen carefully without drawing attention to oneself, you can hear him raving aloud as he stalks back and forth in a confined space in a trance that's opening his mind to the unhidden realities of theoretical physics. The final guest, Ian, was not initially fooled by the grandeur of the train station. In fact, he offered to buy a substantial amount of the company to keep the wheels turning on the tracks. Nonetheless, he was our guest, and I couldn't bear to have his experience ruined by worrying about the well-being of the train. Upon departing, Ian remembers the glory days as an all-American decathlete, but looks forward to his new career as a computer science guy. He has become infatuated with Dungeons & Dragons once more, to the extent that he now must fulfill the prophecy that Morpheus gave him, to begin to believe and become Neo, the savior of the Matrix. Maybe his real-life trinity will save him from the danger of the machines. As for me, your conductor, what will happen next will not be in the norm. As a proud Irish-American, I am here to preach to all of you the past of a proud, tiny island nation. Before complaints are raised, let me firstly state that yes, I am American, and I am also Irish. You can be both. That's why we live in America. We, as humans, are unique because of our past. Our heritage reminds oneself how far we have struggled or triumphed during both the difficult and the prosperous. Simply put, in this brief statement, I will show you my third heart, the one guarded fiercely, as I recount some noticeable moments of Irish history that I have kept close. Knowledge gathered personally through learned life experiences and through the course here at Carroll College, History of Ire. Welp. Time to let this train go one last time until it hops off the tracks into the abyss below. The early history of Ireland is one of mythology and narration, whose knowledge was carried by word of mouth by ancient Irish priests and educators known as Druids. The Druids memorized everything, as it was against the law to record what was spoken by them, since knowledge is power, and in that era, the Druid's position in society was solidified. Hence, all knowledge would have to be passed down through word of mouth. The same history we have today of Ireland comes from this oral tradition. A subsequent British incursion into the island would result in laws being passed by the British monarchy, like the Education Act and the Penal Laws, which essentially prohibited Irish Catholics from receiving any form of education and participating politically within the Irish Parliament. To be educated during this period of history ensured your voice was to be spoken aloud, to not fall behind or be forgotten. One notices the Druid's influence in the mingling of history and myth for the six migration tales of Ireland. The mythology of the first settlers of Ireland narrates the story of the Caesar and her consort, the shapeshifter Fintan, the Fomorians, who were kidnapping Cyclops, the race of makers known as the Pathalon, the gentle race of the Menidians, the Firmbolg, and the Tutha de Dana, the little people, the fairies that lived in Ire, with the Hill of Tara, a place where the High Kings of Ireland were crowned as the entrance to the beyond. The little people are the fairies. Truthfully, though, history recounts the settlers in ancient Ireland at the Paleolithic people in County Clare, the Neolithic people found in Boyne Valley, the Bell Beaker culture, and the Celts who arrived in two ways, the Q Celts from Western Europe and the Sea Celts from the British Islands. The purpose of the myth to replace the accounts of history allows for the Irish people, particularly the Druids, to create their own odyssey for their origin. Within these tales, the Druids depart their wisdom to the newer generations, shaping them so they could become great leaders, warriors, or tribe members in ancient Irish society. From this, the Celtic people could connect under a shared story that forms the foundation of who the Celtic people are, how they came to be in Ireland, and what their culture is. Another instance of intermixing is in the story of how St. Patrick came to love the Irish people. In the tale, Meeting of Old Man, Oisin, a little person, is returning from the land of the ever young. As he comes upon St. Patrick planning in the garden church, St. Patrick sees a huge, youthful man on horseback heading to the church from the distance, but he turns old when he disparks the horse right in front of his eyes. St. Patrick then rushes to him and says, "You have sat too long astride in the sun," with Oisin responding, "Old man, old man." Here, St. Patrick witnessed firsthand the spiritual resolve of the Irish people as he saw, from his viewpoint, how they were willing to sacrifice their youth traveling in a pilgrim of faith so that they may be closer with God at church. This essentially helped mend his hatred of the Irish and turned it into love, a hatred that was initially born when he was captured by Irish pirates from his Roman-style villa in the British Isles and become a slave for many years. From a slave to becoming the patron saint of Ireland for both Catholics and Protestants alike. The Great Irish Famine is a tale of the lack of empathy for the suffering and the ravages of starvation that the Catholic poor of Ireland experienced. The Irish lumper was a staple commodity for the poor before its failure, a potato that could feed and sustain entire families for months. The Whig administration in England believed that the market would provide the food that the Irish needed to survive, despite Ireland continuing to export the same food as a means to keep up on rent set by the absentee English landlords. Such circumstances left the people of Ireland with two apparent choices, to either stay in Ireland and die from starvation or to risk their own lives by embarking across the Atlantic in a coffin ship to North America. The condition of starvation became so dire within Ireland that individuals were utilizing any means possible to survive another day. Many were found dead laying off to the side of the road with stained green lips from eating grass or died from practicing bleeding, a meal that required the slicing of a part of a cow so that its blood may be mixed in a bowl with wild mushroom to be repeated as many times as possible and shared amongst the family. If that wasn't enough, parents had to make the difficult decision to suffocate their own children rather than to watch them starve or choose to feed the child who is most likely to survive and continue to work. Those who didn't die from outright starvation were more susceptible to die from diseases as their immune system was compromised by the lack of substance needed to adequately protect the body. The British government at the time thought the Irish were lazy workers, and as such, they thought that it would be best to build roads, which is where the saying comes, building roads that lead to nowhere. As malnourished, Irish citizens would die building these roads that had no substantial purpose. The Dulu tragedy illustrates this lack of empathy with how Britain handled the genocide of the Irish people. The account goes that 500 individuals within County Mayo walked 12 miles in the rainy night to arrive at Delphi Lodge to convince the British officials in charge that their town still needed food aid. Yet, they were denied entry and forced to march home, where many died in the ditches as their remaining strength was spent to reach their potential salvation. It was believed that many were blown away by the wind into Lake Dullo due to how thin they become, with renowned author McKnight describing how the people are flying, tumbling, and soaring, lit by the full moon and heading over the water, silent. Death in the coffin ships was just as prominent aboard these vessels as it was on the soil of Ireland. Within these ships, the poor and starving citizens of Ireland were crammed into the holds below deck, where overcrowding bred an environment ripe for diseases. Around 20,000 people died between 1845 through 1855, with sharks known to have followed these ships, as the dead were often thrown overboard to create more room for the living. The Irish submitted themselves to becoming human cargo if it meant that there was any possibility of escaping the famine. This lack of empathy is evident in these coffin ships, as the captains of these ships could have instituted proper conditions for these Irish immigrants, but instead chose profit over the health of their passengers. It was the lack of empathy by those in charge, the inhumane conditions of the coffin ships, and the suffering of the Irish that solidified this period in Irish history known as the Great Famine. Now we shall talk about the Eastern Rising, a defiant declaration for Irish independence and the brave few who sacrificed everything to heed the call. The responsibility for the aftermath of the Eastern Rising falls wholeheartedly upon General Bloody Maxwell. The forces of Irish insurgents were eventually overrun by the ever-increasing presence of British soldiers and their advanced weaponry. This left Bloody Maxwell to become the de facto ruler of Ireland, who seized this opportunity to implement martial law on all its citizens. During this, he detained and court-martialed over 3,500 Irish citizens, more than double of those who were fighting during the Rising. Bloody Maxwell believed that it was his duty to inflict the most severe sentences on the known organizers of this detestable ring and on those commanders who took an active part in the actual fighting which occurred. It is evident that he did not consider the fallout of such a mentality, and frankly ignored the plausible repercussion that would occur if one was to choose to amass and imprison the populace and execute those who are regarded as the voices of ire. This sentiment from Bloody Maxwell seems to indicate that he perceived the actions that occurred during Eastern Rising as a personal affront to all that is glory of Britain, resulting in his desire for retribution in the payment of blood, so that the enslavement of ire by the British will never be questioned again due to the fear he hopes to distill into the populace. The executions ordered by Bloody Maxwell instead ignited a shift towards nationalism amongst the populace. The suppression of news could no longer prevent them from learning how these voices of ire and his people were being treated by the British military. While the populace began to support Irish freedom, those who were incarcerated during the Rising were concentrated together in the same prisons. This supplied the Irish militants the necessary time to group together and prepare to continue the struggle for freedom. But for those who were put to death for their participation in the Rising, they had been immortalized like the warriors of old. Now I shall mention those executed for participating in the Rising. April 26, 1916. The document for the Provisional Government of the Irish Republic was signed by the five leaders of the Irish Republican Brotherhood: Patrick Pearse, Joseph Mary Plunkett, Eamon Sent, Sean MacDiarmada, and Thomas Clark. The other signatures consisted of the two leaders of the Irish Citizen Army, who were James Connolly and Thomas MacDonald. May 3, 1916. The first rounds of executions transpired on May 3rd, only 4 days after the start of the Rising. During the executions, the presence of a priest was refused, denying Clark, Pearse, and MacDonald the right to have their last rites before facing their death by a firing squad. Thomas Clark was a heavily respected member of the Irish Republican Brotherhood and the Military Council, which was why he was given the honor of being the first person to sign the proclamation. He was a man adamant against surrender, as he desired to die fighting like the warriors of Ire had done before him. When his wife visited him in Kilmaham jail, he professed that he was proud of the Easter Rising and how it was time for him to die, as the generations of Ire must now carry the mantle of freedom. Thomas MacDonald was a prominent figure in the Gaelic League, which was a revival of Gaelic education to learn one's heritage and culture. During the Rising, he was the commandant of the garrison at Jacob's biscuit factory, a key stronghold in holding the line against British incursion. Patrick Pearse was the president of the provisional government and the commander-in-chief of its forces, which is why the responsibility fell upon him to formally surrender the Irish Republican Brotherhood forces to Bloody Maxwell. Pearse was an eminent member of the Gaelic League and was bestowed the privilege of reading out the entirety of the proclamation for the provisional government of the Irish Republic outside of the General Post Office, declaring to all that they uphold the sovereignty of Ireland from the malicious influence of outsiders. May 4, 1916. The second round of executions occurred on May 4th, with the British stealing the corpses of Daly, O'Hanrahan, Pearse, and Plunkett as a means of denying the relatives the remains of their loved ones so that the bodies could be destroyed by being buried in quicklime. Of the four executed on this day, only Plunkett was the signer of the proclamation. The execution of Edward Daly stems from his rank of commandant of four corps and the intense fighting that transpired under his defense of Irish territory, while the execution of Michael O'Hanrahan is due to being third in command at Jacob's Biscuit Factory, serving alongside MacDonald and MacBride, both of whom were also executed. William Pearse was fated for execution based upon his association with Patrick Pearse, as he was a younger brother and loyal follower of a senior member in the rising. They shared a close bond with one another, with Patrick swearing to William that he would do all that he could to free Ireland or die in the attempt. Despite Joseph Plunkett receiving surgery days before the rising, for he was suffering from glandular tuberculosis, he was still seen participating with a gaping wound in his neck. As a member of the military council and a signer of the proclamation, he joined the line of men to be executed. May 5th, 1916. The execution on May 5th of Major John MacBride is another instance of observed association influencing the final decision. John MacBride was not initially aware of the rising still continuing on, as he had heard the countermanding order and believed that the efforts for resistance had been postponed momentarily. He, however, quickly joined when he learned those orders were ignored. He has had previous experience fighting against the British during the Boer War in South Africa and only played a minor role in the rising. Yet, it was his previous marriage to Maud Gome that made it seem he was more of a senior member than he actually was. Maud Gome was known as the most beautiful woman in Ireland. She was a founding member of the women's group Daughters of Ireland, which was dedicated to Irish independence and the promotion of Irish culture. Her role in Irish culture and Irish right to rule meant that MacBride's involvement in the rising was appraised as more than just happenstance. May 8, 1916. On this day, Con Copeland, Michael Mullen, Sean Houston, and Eamon Sinnott were executed. Only Sinnott was a signer of the proclamation. Even though Con Copeland was not a senior leader of the rising, it was his love of his country that facilitated his involvement in the rising, combined with his membership in the Gaelic League, the Irish Republican Brotherhood, and the Irish Volunteers that singled him out when the British decided who would be executed. Colbert was a steadfast advocate for Gaelic nationalism and a devout Catholic who can be defined by his favorite phrase, "For my God and for my country." Michael Mullen was the chief of staff for the Irish Citizen Army and the commandant for St. Stephen's Garden. On the eve of his execution, Mullins wrote a letter to his wife saying, "The sentence will be carried out by shooting, and so must Irishmen pay for trying to make Ireland a free nation." He also said, "Ireland will come out greater and grander, but she must not forget she is Catholic. She must keep her faith." It is this ideal of self-sacrifice that the participating members of the rising held onto for strength when victory for Irish independence seemed so far out of reach. These last words that Mullen wrote to his wife reflect the mindset that these men went willingly to their deaths with their heads held high because they knew that the momentum had begun and one day Ireland shall be free once more. Sean Houston was a young Finnan Irriman volunteer who was commanded to hold a position in the Mendicity Institution for 2 hours to provide valuable time for other Irish forces to position themselves appropriately for the incoming British incursion. The 25-year-old Houston ignored these orders and maintained that position with his teenage scout for over 3 days, wounding 9 soldiers and killing a British officer. and it became known by the other battalions across the city that Houston was still standing firm against the might of the British, which inspired the other Irish bastions to do the same. It was this brave act of defiance against British rule in Ire and the dishonor Houston brought to the British military that when they learned that it was merely boys who resisted them for so long, resulted in Sean Houston to become immortalized with the leaders of Ire who were to be executed. Eamon Sinn was a teacher in the Gaelic League, a founding member of the Irish Volunteers in 1913, and a signer of the proclamation for the Provisional Government. He was the commandant of the 4th Battalion of Irish Volunteers, and his last letter before he was executed, he wrote that, "In the years to come, Ireland will honor those who have risked all for her honor at Easter in 1916. In the moments leading up to his death, Sinnott recognized that although the Easter Rising could be classified as a military failure, it was ultimately successful when it came to stimulating the populace of Ire to realize that the British do not treat them as equal, and that these citizens of Ire who have sacrificed their lives on this Easter day did so to protect the honor of Ire that is being violated by British occupation. May 12, 1916. The 4-day halt of executions from May 8th to May 12th can be attributed to the British Prime Minister Asquith accepting the pleas of leniency, as he had determined that any more executions would be improper and cause more long-term damage than good. However, on the day that Asquith arrived on the soil of Ire, General Bloody Maxwell ignored his orders and executed the last remaining signers of the Proclamation of the Irish Republic. Sean MacDiarmada was a prominent member of the Gaelic League, and a signature on the Proclamation of the Irish Republic was second to that of Clark, emphasizing the importance that the other senior leaders of the Rising regarded him with. As the leading planner for the Rising, it is theorized whether the outcome would have been different if his strategy was not impeded by the countermanding order to not engage in the Rising or the lack of promised German weaponry. He fully believed that it was up to the people of Ire to illustrate their willingness for independence, even if it meant death, so that the forces of Britain would understand that the resolve of the Irish could never break. James Connolly was a champion of the working classes and believed that both Protestants and Catholics alike would benefit from Irish separation. He was the commander general of the Rising that issued orders for every citizen of Ire, the founder of the Irish Citizen Army, and a signer of the proclamation. He gave the order to charge the general post office, a pivotal moment of no return, and stretched a banner across the Liberty Hall that said, "We serve neither king nor Kaiser, but Ireland." A banner that reminded bystanders of the Rising, the citizens of Ire, that their struggle is for the very soul of Ire. Their cause is to save the island before it is too late, and it is ultimately destroyed by unlawful British occupation. During the Rising, he was hit by a ricochet bullet that shattered his ankle, but he continued to still give out orders, lying injured while the fighting consumed everything. He was given the duty of surrendering the Citizen Army when Pierce surrendered the forces of the Irish Republican Brotherhood. For 5 days, the British doctors and nurses in the Red Cross Military Hospital did what they could to save Connolly's life as the infection from the shattered ankle was turning deadly. Their effort was cut short when Bloody Maxwell ordered him to be executed while he was tied to a chair, for he could not stand, and shot to death by a firing squad. Now I shall read a poem written by William Yeats titled Easter 1916, after which I will confine my own analysis of this material. Easter 1916. I have met them at close of day, coming with vivid faces, from counter or desk among gray 18th century houses. I have passed with a nod of the head, or polite meaningless words, or have lingered a while and said, polite, meaningless words, and thought before I had done of a mocking tale or a jibe, to please a companion or on the fire at the club, being certain that they and I but believed where motley is worn, all changed utterly, a terrible beauty is born. The woman's days were spent in ignorant goodwill, her nights in argument until her voice grew shrill. What voice more sweet than hers when young and beautiful? She rode to harriers. This man had kept a school and rode our wigand horse. This other, his helper and friend, was coming into his force. He might have won fame in the end, so sensitive his nature seemed, so daring and sweet his thought. This other man I had dreamed, a drunken, vanglorous lout. He had done most bitter wrong to some who are near my heart, yet I number him in this song. He too has resigned his part in the casual comedy. He too has been changed in his turn, transformed utterly. A terrible beauty is born. Hearts with one purpose alone, through summer and winter seem, enchanted to a stone to trouble the living stream. The horse that comes from the road, the rider, the birds that range, from clouds to stumbling cloud, minute by minute they change. A shadow of cloud on the stream changes minute by minute. A horse hoof slides on the brim, and a horse splashes within it. The long-legged moorings dive, and hens to moor cocks call. Minute by minute they live, the stones in the midst of all. Too long a sacrifice can make a stone of the heart. Oh, when may it suffice that is heaven's part. Our part to murmur name upon name, as a mother names her child when sleep at last has come on limbs that have run wild. What is it but nightfall? No, no, not night, but death. Was it needless death after all? For England may keep faith for all that is done and said. We know their dream enough to know they dreamed and are dead. And what if excess of love bewildered them till they died? I write it out in a verse. MacDonald and McBride and Connolly and Pierce. Now and in time to be, wherever green is worn, our change, change utterly, a terrible beauty is born. In the aftermath of the Easter Rising, renowned Irish poet W.B. Yeats wrote an influential piece of literature titled Easter 1916 that commemorates the fallen MacDonald, McBride, Connolly, and Pierce. Pierce was immortalized as, "This man had kept the school and rode our winged horse." Yeats regards Pierce as someone who could have carried Ireland beyond this cycle of violence and oppression, to fly beyond the blood-soaked soil of Ireland's own people and to bring its people, whether Catholic or Protestant, into heaven's domain once more. Yeats spends a moment to spare a thought, laminating on his friend MacDonald, who is now gone, writing, "This other, his helper and friend, was coming into his fourth. He might have won fame in the end, so sensitive his nature seemed, so daring and sweet his thought." Dwelling on how the struggle for Irish sovereignty has continued to consume the people of Ireland, as if they were a resource to be added to the furnace to keep the flames of independence alive, even if it meant that personal ambition for literature eminence or any other avenue in life must become a necessary casualty in the call for Ireland's freedom. When Yeats mentions MacBride, it lacks the same praises seen previously with Pierce and MacDonald, in which he credits him as, "This other man I have dreamed, a drunken, vainglorious lout. He had done most bitter wrong to some who are near my heart, yet I number him in this song." MacBride's character is criticized in this instance because of his past marriage with Maud Gome, someone that Yeats cared deeply for and was greatly upset by how she was treated during their union. Despite how Yeats perceives MacBride's moral character, he still acknowledges and respects his willingness to participate in a cause that would surely mean the end of his life. This is why MacBride is given the honor to be associated with the names of MacDonald, Pierce, and Connolly, for when the call is given to fight for Irish freedom, he accepted wholeheartedly. At the end of this poem, Yeats enshrines the outcome of the Eastern Rising as, "Now and in time to be, wherever green is worn, our change, change utterly, a terrible beauty is born." Signifying to all who may read this poem that those who participated in the Easter Rising have accomplished a monumental day in Irish history. Those who have fought and those who have died, those who were imprisoned and those who have lost everything have achieved the impossible dream. A dream that has changed the color green into symbolizing cries of sovereignty, a cry that has formed the newly established Irish government under the proclamation of the Irish Republic, a cry that is still carried out till this day. Listeners, I could say it's been a blast. Maybe it has, maybe it hasn't. Maybe you enjoy this, maybe you don't. But I will say this. Choo-choo. Choo-choo. The train has made its final stop.
Big Sky Small World is sponsored by the Carroll College Communication Center.
C4.
Helping the Carroll and Helena communities with presentations, multimedia, and podcasting since 2020.
C4.
Find us in the library or email Director Alan Hansen at ahansen@carroll.edu.
All right. Can you introduce yourself and describe your role as the president of Engineers Without Borders and captain of the pole vault team?
Hello. My name is Josh Smalley, and I am currently both the captain of the pole vault crew on the Carroll track and field team, as well as the president of Engineers Without Borders.
Nice. All right. Yeah. I should have probably introduced you. I'm here with Josh Smalley. He is the captain of the track team and president of the Engineers Without Borders Club, and also a member of the Guatemala chapter in the Engineers Without Borders Club. Words are hard sometimes. All right, first question. What motivated you to take on leadership roles in both Engineers Without Borders and on the pole vault team?
Well, for me, it kind of just came naturally for track. There wasn't a lot of pole vaulters when I came to this program. I mean, we had some really good ones in the past, but there wasn't any when I got here. And so as I kind of progressed, qualified for nationals a couple of times, and just kind of know more people on the track team, it kind of just happened a little more naturally, especially in the vault crew. But for Engineers Without Borders, I joined the club my junior year, technically, and started attending regularly. And I wasn't able to travel that year because I didn't have my passport yet. But at the end of the year, when they were voting for or nominating leadership roles, I just decided that was a good place for me to kind of be, you know. And we needed a president, so I decided to step up to the role. That's how I got involved in that aspect of Engineers Without Borders.
So would you say that in track, in a more athletic aspect, you became a leader because of your skill, and then in a more organizational aspect with Engineers Without Borders, you became a leader because of your experience and dedication and also intelligence with the whole club?
Yeah, I would say that could be accurate. I don't often feel very knowledgeable with Engineers Without Borders, but it's like the attendance is so young, like, you know, there's not a lot of people that have been involved with it for multiple years right now. And there's like, we traveled this year, but before that, for last year, there hadn't really been a group that traveled in a while because of COVID. And so it doesn't feel like we're starting to build knowledge again, but there isn't a ton of knowledge that was passed on to us. So, but yes, compared to those around me, I felt knowledgeable enough to lead.
Yeah, especially since there's so many new people in the club. How would you describe your leadership style, and how does it vary between leading a club and leading a sports team?
A lot of what I do for both of these roles is just coordination. So passing information along, getting in contact with coach for track and with professors for Engineers Without Borders, and passing information along so that everything can be coordinated a little more smoothly. With track, that's usually a lot easier because a lot of my communication has to happen early in the year, figuring out people's schedules and coordinating that with available times for coaching, and then after a little while, we can get in a groove, and my role is a lot easier. For Engineers Without Borders, usually coming up with topics to discuss and working a little bit outside of club time to make sure that we're meeting our goals.
All right, cool. So when you were talking about Guatemala and how we traveled to Guatemala with the Engineers Without Borders Club, and for the actual Engineers Without Borders Club, you are the president, but for the specific Guatemala chapter, you're technically just a member. And so in what ways do you think you helped lead the group that went as our technically club president when we were in Guatemala, helping to rebuild the school there?
Yeah, so just having been, I didn't get to travel last year, like I said, but having been around the project, my knowledge was a little bit better than those that were traveling with, than a lot of people on the travel team. So I was able to kind of guide people through that aspect. I also have a little bit more construction knowledge, so I was able to take a leadership role in kind of showing other people on like more like the physical aspect of the construction, what we needed to get done.
So, all right. How do you approach decision making when you're not entirely sure like what to do when it comes to both Engineers Without Borders and also the track team?
I'd like to say that I've got a pretty logical mindset about things, so I like to break things down for myself. If I still can't come to a conclusion, and even if I have come to my own conclusion, I like to consult those that I think are also knowledgeable on the subject. So getting in contact with Bodine, Professor Bodine for Engineers Without Borders, or discussing things with other pertinent members of the club to kind of get their input on where they think we should be at or what we should be doing in the week to come. Yeah.
And for the track team?
Yeah, for the track team, a lot of times it feels like the decisions aren't necessarily in my hands. Like, I can do my best to make sure that everyone can make practices or, you know, that everything is lining up for people's schedules. But sometimes there's not really much I can do other than just kind of guide things a little bit.
Yeah, it's mostly based off of the people. All right. What leadership strategies have you learned for sports that you apply to Engineers Without Borders?
That's a good question. I would say, think here. Probably just like using people skills. I wouldn't say that I was always necessarily a super good people person, but I kind of developed those skills in high school, and then have continued those skills in like the track aspect here with teammates and coaches. So just kind of applying that, ability to be a people person and accommodate for those that I'm organizing, working with. So
yeah, and also it kind of like being able to be a people person is makes it easier to ask for help when you know that you need it, I guess.
It's true.
Yeah. How do you foster a positive and productive team culture within Engineers Without Borders and the pole vault team?
I like to keep things light. Obviously, there's times when, you know, things can't be taken lightly, but anytime that it can be, I like to try and keep it light. Kind of make people laugh a little bit, keep joking. Try to encourage those around me. There's a lot of times in track when, you know, we're going through a hard workout or someone's just having a rough vault day, and it's like, I don't know, try and bring them up, tell them they can do it, and encourage them in that.
Yeah, I've been on the receiving end of that a lot. Sometimes those days just don't work out. And how do you try to do that with the Engineers Without Borders team? Because I mean, with the track team, you really do it by leading by example and making sure that everyone's having a good day. And then when they're not having a good day, yeah, you definitely come over and be nice to me and, and make sure that I have a smile on my face by the end of it. But how do you do that in Engineers Without Borders? Because, I mean, most of that, a lot of the time, is just a lot of paperwork. And then, I mean, in my opinion, the only real fun part of the club is when you travel.
It's true. It's true.
But the paperwork, the traveling makes it all worth it.
Yeah, it's true. I think more like just in my intros, like at the beginning, I try to keep things light, keep people entertained a little bit. And then, yeah, I try to keep kind of like just a charismatic, a little bit like a joking attitude while we're in there, because obviously we're just, you know, a lot of it's paperwork and fundraising stuff, which isn't always the most fun. But I think if you keep a light attitude, you can keep people engaged and keep them coming back for more.
Yeah. How do you handle moments of uncertainty or doubt in your leadership role?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would say, I don't know, remembering that, you know, to a certain extent, you can fake it till you make it, you know, kind of thing. But also, like, people don't expect me to have all the answers. And that's okay. Like, I wish I had all the answers, you know, like, I don't know. They don't expect me to know everything.
Yeah.
Or it's okay for me not to know everything in both aspects, both track and Engineers Without Borders.
Yeah. It's kind of wild that sometimes, because, I mean, for me, you've always, I came into college and I knew you, and you were just like, oh, he was the sophomore of the year above me. And I was still an engineering student at that time, so I looked up to you. And now you're a higher up engineering student and you're still doing so good at track. And it's like, wow, this kid's smart. It's hard to believe that he doesn't know everything.
That's my bad.
Come on, Josh. And you're a 4.0 student. Gosh, you should know everything.
Yeah, I try my best.
Yep.
Just not possible.
Nope. It's wild. What's one leadership lesson you've learned through your experiences in Engineers Without Borders and athletics?
It's better to come prepared. A lot of times I like to just show up and go with the flow. But if you really want to, like, be an effective leader, it's better to come into it with some knowledge, you know, go into the meet knowing what the starting height or what you know, who's going to be there. Go into a meeting knowing what you want to talk about, knowing what needs to get done that week. And I can't say that I'm always the best at that, but I've learned that that's very valuable.
Yeah. How do you continue to grow and improve as a leader, even when facing uncertainty?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I like to keep it light. And I like to think that I've got a good growth mindset. So even if I go into a meeting and kind of just, I don't know, I'm not very good at guiding people and everything, or I go into a track practice and I have a rough day myself, I just kind of, I feel like I'm good at keeping a growth mindset. Not believing that single day or single meeting defines who I am in those roles. So I would say keeping a growth mindset is very valuable.
Making sure you have an open mind. All right. So in the Engineers Without Borders Club, you tend to be a lot more involved with the Guatemala chapter. And there's another chapter that the Engineers Without Borders Club has, the Uganda chapter. How do you try to incorporate yourself more into a leadership role so that the Guatemala, or so that the Uganda chapter can also see you as their president and not just the Guatemala chapter?
Yeah. We made sure that the president and vice president each were from a different side of the club. So one for Uganda, one for Guatemala. So the vice president currently is from the Uganda chapter. Yeah, I do like the intros to the meetings and kind of split off and then guide their attention to the vice president kind of as their leader for the rest of the meeting. So I'd say just those intros is probably the most where I define myself as the president for both sides of the club. And then after that, I don't always know exactly what they're working on for their project. So I leave it up to their leaders to guide them any further.
So you divide and conquer, kind of split up power and make it kind of take a little bit of the workload off yourself so you're not completely focusing on like two separate projects. You got your own stuff.
Yeah. Delegation is something that they told us to do pretty early on. You know, when we've got 10 club members on each side, you know, I mean, you don't need to do everything yourself, and no one has time to do all of it themselves. So delegation is important.
Did you learn delegation from experience, or did you learn that in a class of like engineering, or was it suggested to you by one of your mentors in the club?
It was suggested to me by one of my mentors, and then I learned pretty early on in my presidency that it, like, at first, you know, it's almost hard to delegate if that's not what you're used to, but you do it once or twice and realize that, like, people aren't going to hate you for giving them tasks, and they want something to do sometimes. So, yeah, early on discovered that, yeah, it's fine. It's actually preferable, you know, for everybody. So,
yeah. Who do you see as like a good mentor? Like, who has influenced your leadership style the most in what you do in all aspects?
Say probably my dad was a really good role model for me growing up. Yeah, I would say he was probably my best mentor in leadership. So,
how so? How did he lead stuff that made you see him as a mentor?
I mean, just like the family in general, he's a really good leader. And also, like in our church, he holds a position of a deacon currently, and he's really good in that role. Yeah, I've just always looked up to him and seen the way that he leads. And so, yeah, he's been a really good influence on me.
Nice. All right. Is there anything else about, or no, actually, I had another question. How do you think that you're going to take what you've learned in Engineers Without Borders and also track and then apply it to leadership positions that you might have in the future in engineering firms?
Yeah, so a complaint a lot of people have with engineers is that they're disconnected from the actual physical work that they're directing or designing. And so I think to be a well-rounded engineer and leader in such things, it's really good to get hands-on experience like we did in Guatemala, where not only like we designed or helped design the project, but then we actually went down and constructed it with our own hands and got to see where we could have made improvements to our plan, or we could have accounted for just different aspects that you don't necessarily see on the design side. So I think for future work, that was a valuable experience for me. And then regarding track, I would say just determination, you know, motivating yourself. Yeah, a lot of hard workouts, a lot of long workouts, and rough weeks, rough months, you know, rough seasons where it's just like you got to stay motivated, stay connected to those around you, and kind of not only like pull yourself up, but also be able to rely on the community that you're involved in to help lift you up. So I think that's kind of one of the more valuable lessons that I've pulled from not only just being a leader in track, but also just being part of the community.
Yeah. When I asked you the question about specific role models that you had, you said your dad. I obviously don't know your dad, but I do know the leaders that I've seen in those specific general areas. In track, we have Coach Clark. And then for Engineers Without Borders, we had Morley when we were in Guatemala. And what leadership models did you see that those two specific people have that you would like to then try and use in the future?
They're both, I would say, in different ways, they kind of have like a silent like confidence to them. But also like, I don't know, a silent confidence that kind of shows they're like, that they know their stuff. And then on the other hand, they're like personable, like willing to talk with you and just like really down to earth, easy to talk to. So I think that's a good balance in leadership where you can kind of show people like, or like hold yourself in a confident manner, but also be able to just be connected with those around you as well.
All right. So obviously you're going to continue doing engineering because you're an engineer, and you might rise up through the ranks and become a lead engineer in that aspect. But with athletics and pole vault, how do you think you're going to possibly continue leading in that? Do you think you might become a coach and of some sort?
I've thought about it. Yeah, I mean, we'll see where life takes me, but it would definitely be interesting to try and assist some high school coaching. I just don't know, just don't know where I'm going to land yet quite, or what my time is going to look like. So maybe.
All right, cool. I think that was a good interview. Thank you for your time, Josh. Is there anything else that you would like to say? Any final thoughts or words of wisdom that you would like to give us?
In terms of words of wisdom, for anyone who out there that wants to pole vault, let me tell you, anticipate and create.
And drive and hit it like a hammer.
Yeah, hammer it.
Good, I love it. That was specifically to me.
Yes, it was.
All right. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for interviewing me, Aiden.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye. Big sky, small world, like a mountain high, mountain alone.
So go to the big sky. Thank you for tuning in to Big Sky, Small World. Theme music by Alex Coulter. Please follow and leave comments on Instagram at bigsky.smallworld. Tune in next week.
Josh, okay, stop.
We're off to a good start.
Okay.